Lord our God, it's been our joy to worship you. And we know that you are a God who loves to give us good things. And we thank you that you have made yourself known to us and that you give us the Bible. And we believe that this book, written by so many different people in different times and in different places, is your word. It's living and it's active and it speaks to us today. And it is a wonderful gift. And we thank you for the gift of Kenny, for who he is, and all that he brings to this church family and beyond. And we ask that tonight you be, through your Spirit, you would help us to hear what your word is saying as he opens it up to us, and as he reads from Colossians, and as he points out to us what it is that you are saying. So God, we ask that you'd help us.
And thank you to Tim for reading that passage. I asked him to read that even though he just preached it 2 weeks ago, because it's, I think, essential for us to be able to understand the passage that we're going to be talking about tonight. In fact, I think that the three verses that I'll be kind of presenting to you guys tonight is just a continuation of that passage that he brought to you 2 weeks ago. And it's an amazing passage. It's one of my favorites, and I've moaned about this for the last month, so I'm going to try not to too much, but you got that passage, and I got this one, and I remember, and this is my confession, I remember saying to him, gosh, it's only three verses, I feel sorry for whoever gets that passage, but I'm eating my words, and that's the truth of it, because it's such a rich passage as well. And if we can get the PowerPoint up, just to kind of show all the various different things that describe God. I know it's a bit small, but that's going to be our main sort of slide so that we're all on the same page. So Jesus is the image of God. He's the firstborn over all creation. He is, and I love this, he's the creator of the universe. So if that's not something that says, like, screams out of the page of your CV, I don't know what is, but Jesus is the creator of the universe. He's the head of the church. He's the firstborn from the dead. He's the fullness of God. And in verse 20, it says that he's the reconciler of all things. And so this is just a continuation from that theme to talk a bit more about reconciliation and hope. And so those are just the basic themes that we're going to be talking about. Now, in verse 20, it needs to be said that there are some people who are called universalists who believe that everybody is going to be going to heaven no matter what. And that's one of the things that Origen said back in the third century. And he took verse 20 to defend that. And I don't know what he was doing, because you could just read on. And in verse 23 here, you can probably just see it. There's an if. There's an if, and it's not an ominous if. But we kind of balk, because we're so strong in grace in worshiping Jesus. And we see an if, and we go, ooh. But we'll come to that in a minute. We'll come to that shortly. So verse 21, I'm just going to take three verses, one at a time. Verse 21 says, once you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior. So I think... Evil behavior. Am I evil? I think I'm okay. You know, or what about you? You think you're evil? I think, no, you guys seem pretty decent human beings. I mean, I'm looking around and I don't see anybody that strikes me as evil straight away, but that's actually the truth of it. That's the truth of it, that because God is holy and he's completely set apart, if we don't meet that standard, that makes us fall short. That's equal to evil. We are evil in his eyes. We are alienated from him. We are his enemies. And these are words that Paul is not using just flippantly. Alienated and enemies. Just the next image to kind of illustrate my point. So we all know who that is. Guy Fawkes, the Guy Fawkes mask. And what that symbolizes in our society, at least in the Western society, is rebellion, something that goes against the grain, something that is against the establishment. And there's a couple of times that we see this mask and we think, yeah, I could get behind that, because it's against things that we perceive as being unjust. But just to think about what it means to be rebellious, to be like Guy Fawkes, to be alienated, to be an enemy of the state. Now, I remember back in, I think it was 2010 or early 2011, and we hadn't been here long, but I went out to Princes Street because I wanted to see the Pope drive by in the Popemobile on Princes Street. I took my camera with me, and I got up on a big perch. I was kind of like Zacchaeus to see the Pope drive by in his Popemobile, and I was all excited. I was like, yes, I get to see the Pope. That's really neat. And sure enough, he drove by in the Popemobile, and if you know anything about the Popemobile, it's got that big glass bubble over it, and he's got these security guards all around him jogging as they go. And I remember I took a photo with a long lens of the Pope to kind of keep this image forever that I saw the Pope in person. And I went home and put it on the computer, and I kind of zoomed in, and you can see one of the security guards like looking at me like, ooh, this is a threat. And I didn't see it at the time. And still, you know, I thought it's kind of neat to see the Pope drive by on Princes Street, but I was still very separate. I was in a segregated part of the street. I wasn't allowed to approach the vehicle. Even if I could approach the vehicle, I'd just bounce off of that bulletproof glass if I hadn't been tackled by the security guards who were jogging along. You see what I mean here? I'm not necessarily Guy Fawkes in this situation, but I'm not allowed to approach. I'm not allowed to approach the Pope. You can't do that. It's a little bit like the Queen as well. Occasionally the Queen comes and stays at Holyrood House. And I was just discussing with you previously, I walk my dog around Holyrood House just because it's similar. It's kind of close to where we live. And there's these big, big walls, if you've ever been around the back. I don't imagine how you would get in, but occasionally there's people who do try to jump the fence, especially at Buckingham Palace. And what happens to them? They get arrested. They get tackled to the ground. They can't even approach the building that the Queen stays in. And whatever your opinion is of the Queen is irrelevant, because the point is that you're just apart from the Queen, this person who doesn't even hold a state position. You can't approach the Queen. You can't approach authority. Can't even approach Downing Street. Elected officials, and I'm just kind of continuing this theme, you can't approach Downing Street because there must be a barrier. There's the assumption that because we're unknown, we could be anybody. We could be Guy Fawkes himself. We could be rebellious. We could be with a plot, if you will. And I think I'm making it fairly clear here. I'll tell a story in a minute, but the whole point of this is to say that God is holy. And that's a concept that fascinates me and always has, because I don't fully understand holiness. I don't understand what it would be like to be completely without sin, completely without ill motivation, to be nothing but love and completely separate from all of, well, not separate from all of creation entirely, but set apart is a better word. So, just the next slide, just a quick story. What you're looking at is Trafalgar Square, and in the dead center of that is St. Martin's in the Fields. Just a fancy church at Trafalgar Square that I really didn't know much of, but when my wife and I lived there for a year and a half. The church that I was working for, they asked me to go along to a function at this church. It was down in the crypt in the basement. And apparently it was a fundraising event. It was supposed to raise funds for Lambeth, for Hackney, for Camden, Tower Hamlets, a couple of the inner boroughs that we served in. And I said, okay, I'll go. What do you need me to know? What do you want me to bring? And they said, oh, just take yourself. Here's the ticket. Here's the guy that you'll liaise with, and you'll just go. And I, if you don't know me very well, and if you know me very well, just to tell you, I don't own a lot of clothes. And in fact, the one article of clothing that is the oldest thing that I have is probably 10 years old. I had that hoodie on that day. I was just looking a bit bummish, a bit rough. But I went along to this thing, went along to this function, and I get inside, I get into the entrance. I walk on through thinking, I've got my ticket, I've got my invitation, I've got my right to be there. And I walk in, and it's nothing but black suits and some tuxes and some people carrying wine glasses on a plate. I don't know how they do that. It's pretty impressive. It was just that formal. And so I was approached immediately and said, sorry, this is a private event. And I thought, right, but here's my ticket. Here's my invitation with my name on it. And it didn't really help. I felt nothing but judgment all night. And I'll never forget this. I'll never forget it because it's not so much about feeling uncomfortable, but just the overwhelming feeling of I don't belong. I don't belong in this place, and I'm not wanted in this place. That's how I felt. And I'm here to say to you today that here in this passage, Paul is saying that you were once alienated, kind of in the same way. We don't belong with God. We're enemies in our minds because of our behavior. So we are apart from him. We can't approach his holiness the way that we are. And that's sad. And it's bad news. But I'm glad I don't have to stop there. Verse 22 says, but now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death to present you holy in his sight, without blemish, and free from accusations. So these two verses, you could actually advance the slide if you want, just so it's still back on the screen. These two verses here that we've just covered, this is the gospel distilled into two verses. It's all there. And if God hadn't have done this, if God hadn't have overcome my hostility to him through Jesus Christ in his blood, then there wouldn't be any good news to share. But if you think about Guy Fawkes, you think about him for just a minute, and that rebellious kind of attitude, if we were enemies, it's absolutely incredible that God would set about reconciling his enemy to him in the way that presents us holy in his sight. In the same way that God is holy, we are now holy, without blemish and free from accusation. I might say that a couple more times. And only because to hammer home the idea of reconciliation and what that means. Paul only uses this word reconciliation 5 times in the New Testament. 5 times. And I think it's essential that we understand what reconciliation really means in this context. If you imagine just for a minute that you have an enemy who you cannot stand, this enemy who has been horrible to you, this enemy who has maybe been a bully to you. You know, we're all adults, but maybe we can think of a time when we were a child and somebody treated us that badly. Can you imagine that if you got the chance to respond in a way to that person, how loving would you be on your own? Forgiveness? Would you stop there? And that, for some people, that's a step too far. For some people, they would not forgive their enemy. Would you go further than forgiveness if you could bring yourself there? Would you try to reconcile your relationship? That's even more difficult than forgiving, is trying to make things right between you. Very, very difficult. Even for adults, let alone children, of course. Some people go their entire life without reconciling with somebody who hurt them. So then what does God do? He goes even further. He not just forgives, he not just makes things right or okay and continue in relationship, he lavishes upon us. He lavishes upon us. And this is at no cost to us. This is at no cost to us whatsoever. And that's what reconciliation is all about. And it's all because of him. He's done this, not us. So we'll continue in the last verse here. Verse 23. This is the if. It says, if you continue in your faith, established and firm, and do not move from the hope held out in the gospel. This is the gospel that you heard and that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven, and of which I, Paul, have become a servant. So there's two things that I want to tackle in this last verse, and I'll probably spend more time here than previously. There's kind of a, how do I describe this? We're on a road in understanding this verse, and there's a pothole in the middle of it. And we need to understand the pothole so that we can actually appreciate and travel down the road and continue on our journey. Does that make any sense? Anyway, it's the if. We've got to talk about the if. And then we're going to come back to the hope held out in the gospel, because that's the meat. That's the really good bit that I want to talk about. But we're going to get around this if thing for a minute. So this is if we continue in our faith. What does that mean? What does that mean when the gospel has been preached to every creature under heaven? This is the gospel that you heard and has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven. Paul knows that the gospel has not yet reached everybody. He knows that there's still plenty of people who haven't heard the gospel. He himself has said that he is on his way to Spain to deliver it himself, so the job isn't done. And Tertullian, just 100 years later, he would say that, he would talk about Christians and the spread of Christianity. We are of yesterday, and yet we already fill your cities, islands, camps, palace, senates, and forums. We have left you only your temples. So Tertullian is really just saying that this gospel is being proclaimed, and it eventually will be proclaimed all over the place. And it's a reminder to us that the gospel is for everybody. That's a point that I picked up while I was just doing some reading on this passage, and it reminded me, we don't celebrate that often enough. The gospel is not just for Westerners. The gospel is not just for the church that's above ground in a democracy that supports freedom of religion. The gospel is for everybody. All the people who we think maybe a bit less of sometimes. I know we probably have a quite high view of humanity here, and that's good, but we still hold prejudices just because we're people. So the gospel is for the people who we think, do they really deserve that in prison for doing those horrible things? The gospel is for them too. So this, if you continue in your faith, established and firm, and do not move from the hope held out in the gospel, this is the last thing that we need to talk about. So we've addressed the fact that the gospel has been proclaimed, and even though he's attempting to say in the future every creature will hear it, it's a bit of a funny rhetoric there. Maybe just show the next slide. We'll all be very familiar with this image. From 2008, hope is a funny thing to me. I've always thought about hope and what it means for certain people. Because I think hope is one of those things that it can be, you can hope in a very particular thing, or you can hope in a much wider idea. You can hope in a country. You can hope in a person. You can hope in yourself. There's so many different things that we put hope in. And I never really got to thinking about it until that election year when Obama used hope as his campaign slogan. Hope and change is what it was. And I quite like Obama. I like what he's been as a president and a person to represent America. But that puts so much pressure on a man to have that image with hope underneath it. I think he did a lot of great things. But when you say that your candidacy is hope, that's a strong, strong promise. Hope in what? Hope that things will be better? Hope that the poor will be looked after? Hope for those who are downtrodden? What does that mean? Is it all-encompassing hope? Will it, if you vote for Obama, will it make everything okay? Will it change your life? Would it have an impact on your eternity? To put hope underneath your face is bold, very, very bold. And I like the campaign quite a bit, actually. And I think it's a very interesting tool for politics. But what are we hoping in? What are we constantly hoping in ourselves? I'll just give you a personal admission. My wife and I just got a new dog a little less than a week ago. And it's one of those rescues that you picked out, like, online. And we did a lot of work with the rescue center to say, is she going to be suitable for us? You know, can you take some video? And we need to know a lot about her. We want to give her a good home, all that stuff. So once we finally decided on this particular dog, we knew that there would be a date that she would arrive to us. And I'm going to admit that I put a little bit of hope in that event, in that moment, that we'd get a new dog and that would add something to our life. I'm not saying that I put hope in her for my eternity or my salvation or anything like that, but I thought that this dog would be a hope to improve our quality of life. And I think that's okay. I think it's okay to look forward to things, but I'm just admitting to you that I think we put a bit too much hope, because this week we've had to train her. We've had to get her used to where she is, and it's been frustrating. She's a really sweet dog. She's not going anywhere. We're going to keep her. But it's been a frustrating week, because you build this up in your mind that this is going to be so great, and then you realize, like, oh, it's been such a long and busy week and draining because we're not getting any sleep, you know, looking after the dog. I feel like I have a kid, for crying out loud. Sorry. But yeah, like, these are things that we think about when we talk about hope. Is what does this mean for us? What's going to happen? What is it that we get from our hope? Just that hope in the gospel is actually really meaningful. Hope in a presidency, or hope in, I'll say it, even independence or Europe or all of the various different things that I care deeply about. Don't mishear me. I care deeply about these things, but they don't give us eternal hope. They might give us a bit of hope for now, but they don't make our relationship with God more meaningful. Hope in the gospel is hope for sinners. Those people who, back to verse 21, aren't right with God. And that's where we all are before Jesus, is we're not right with God. Even the most kind and gentle and wonderful person among us still falls short of God's incredible holiness. So hope in the gospel is hope for sinners. What kind? Just show you the next image. This is a painting of the alabaster vial, the weeping harlot who is saved by faith. And what does she do? She pours the vial of alabaster, the precious ointment, on Jesus' feet and washes it with her hair, because she's not worthy to be in his presence. She's overwhelmed with his goodness and his kindness. Now, for her, for that woman who's a sinner, a sinner that we would probably all go, ooh, ew, that's a real sinner. Her hope is in Jesus. Her hope is in this man that she kneels before because she believes that he's God. And her response is that of absolute humility and servitude. So that's a hope of forgiveness. She's hoping that she can be forgiven for what she's done. The next slide, please. There's hope of reconciliation. Hope in the gospel is hope for reconciliation, that thing that we've been talking about for most of tonight in my incoherent ramblings. But reconciliation is illustrated here in the prodigal son. This is a Rembrandt of the son who said to his father, I just want your money. I don't want the relationship. I just want my inheritance. Give it to me. I'm gone. And he's away. And he's spending all of his inheritance on luxuries. And he finds himself eating with pigs. And he realizes, oh, I've destroyed my relationship with my father. I could never go back. Maybe I could go and be one of his hired help. And so the prodigal son goes home, and we all know the ending, I hope, is the father runs to meet him and embraces him and lavishes him, gives him his coat off of his back, and gives him stuff, all the stuff that he never thought he'd ever see again. He not just makes things right, but he says, I'm going to give you so much more. I want you to be so welcome. I want you to be so loved. That's hope in the gospel, is hope for reconciliation like that. And just the last example. This is probably fairly unclear. This is not a well-known painting. But this is Jesus cleansing the lepers. This is a hope for holiness. One of the hopes of the gospel is that we hope that we can be made whole again, that we can be complete. We know innately that we're not as God intended us. We know that there's a missing bit. God's put that there so that we can seek him. Holiness and wholeness is what this leper, or these lepers, all sought. And I believe that there was 12 of them, if I remember correctly. So 12 or 10? 10. Yeah, good call. So there's 10 of them, and they all go, and they say, they're begging here in this image to be cleansed and to be made whole and to be made holy again. And Jesus does this, and there's one that comes back to say thank you and to praise Jesus for that. And he is made whole because of his faith. So Jesus doesn't want to just clean their outside and make them well on the outside. He wants to make them whole on the inside. He wants to make us whole on the inside. So Paul says that this is the servant. This is the gospel that he became a servant of. That's what he's describing, is this hope and this reconciliation. I just want to ask you, where are you putting your hope in? What are you putting your hope in? It's okay to care about all the things that we talked about, but ultimately, what carries us through the day?